Welcome to Wessington U3A Family History Group Genealogy Podcast. We are a group of like-minded folks based in Washington, Tyne and Wear, and we meet twice monthly at the village pub to discuss all aspects of our family trees. Recently, we've been working on a project looking into an ancestor timeline. That involves researching into the social and economic factors that affect our ancestors' daily lives. We are going to share some of our findings in this podcast. In this episode, our members are going to discuss various topics, and these will include Cornish miners, First World War findings, including U-boat encounters, recently discovered army ancestors, and then finally, boarders, chairs, and Sunderland Theatre performers. Firstly, Joan is going to tell us how her Cornish ancestors made the long journey to the County Durham coalfield.
I've done family history for a few years now, but I've never researched any of my gran's ancestry. My gran, Grace Ambrosine Northey, was born in 1891 in Eshwinning. So I looked at the 1881 census, where I found him living in Hetley Hall, aged 16, and he was a coal miner, the same as his father, and both were born in Cornwall. Investigating further, I found a newspaper article which was published 1867 in the Cornwall Western Morning News, stating that a representative of the Earl of Durham had held a meeting in the National Schoolroom in Chasewater, wanting to engage men and boys for his little town colliery up north. They were offered a good 12-month contract where all was explained about the work involved, and pay, which was 5 shillings and 6 pence per day per man, and all the family would be transported up north free, and also supply of necessaries given on arrival. It must have sounded good, as like a good deal, as several men and boys signed the contract straight away. Was Richard's father, who worked as a copper miner, one of those who signed? Well, I'm not sure. But as the family were in the 1871 census in Shorten in County Durham, hopefully he did.
It is interesting that folks in the past times travel so far for work and hopefully a new life. Our next section is going to reveal 2 maritime events during First World War and 3 newly discovered fighting uncles. Liz will be in conversation with Bill about the Gidney brothers and their maritime experiences.
Hi, Bill. How long have you been studying family history?
Since before our family history group was formed, maybe 15, maybe 20 years.
So what interested you in the Gidneys?
Well, Albert Gidney was my wife's, Pat's, grandfather, and his brother Edwin was her great-uncle. Both were mariners, both had interesting lives and family folklore attached to them.
Can you tell us about them, please?
Albert Gidney was born in Jarrow in 1874. He attended Jarrow High School and went to sea at 16. He went as an apprentice engineer. He worked hard, he gained his certificates and rose through the ranks, and in the early 1900s became a chief engineer. Family lore gives the following story, some of which are very difficult to verify. In early 1915, the rules of naval engagement were much more gentlemanly than they were later on or today. At the time, Albert was chief engineer on a tramp cargo ship, probably of Potomac, on routine voyage between America, Canada and England, when, following protocol, the rules of war at the time, a submarine surfaced to demand the abandonment of the ship prior to sinking it.
Ooh, that sounds like a frightening situation. What happened next?
Well, it was, but the captain of the submarine had misjudged his position badly and was far too close to the ship, whereupon the captain of the Potomac ordered full speed and rammed the submarine. Both vessels were extensively damaged, the submarine mortally so, and it sank. Whereon the crew of the sub were transferred to the Potomac, which made for Halifax, Nova Scotia, to disembark their prisoners of war, carry out essential repairs, and reprovision. The officers all got on well with their German counterparts, which was perhaps as well because they had to share their quarters with them. However, they duly arrived at Halifax and were duly disembarked.
Did Albert return to active service after that?
Oh, yes. Northeast men are made of stern stuff. Later in the war, it's thought that he was aboard the Tuscarora when in 1917, without warning, it was torpedoed by an unknown submarine. The rules of war had changed. Again, they were off the coast of Nova Scotia on their routine passage from Halifax to London. All hands took to the lifeboats and sailed to Halifax, where they were met by the Salvation Army, who exchanged the engineer's oily boiler suits for a miscellany of clothes.
A very eventful war, having two encounters with U-boats. How did he get back to England?
Well, in 1917, Albert is recorded in immigration records, reference ancestry, as travelling from Halifax to London, first class, on the Cunard five-star liner Asconia. We can imagine how Albert felt in the first-class dining room amongst the dinner jackets, clad in the Salvation Army hand-me-downs. However, his miscellany of clothes were replaced by a kindly purser with a uniform more suited to his ranks. After the war, he was awarded a service medal and a citation, both of which we have, and was gazetted in the London Gazette. In 1924, he renewed his engineering certification, and in about 2 years later, he left the sea. He died in bed in Jarrow in 1935.
That was an interesting story of Albert's life. Can you tell us now about his brother Edwin?
Yes, certainly. Edwin Gidney, Albert's younger brother, was born in Jarrow in 1878. He attended Jarrow High School and he left with a higher certificate in education, which is probably equal to a scholarship level certificate these days. He was an apprentice engineer at Palmer's Shipyard in Jarrow on the River Tyne. On finishing your apprenticeship, all apprentices had to do between 1 and 3 years service away from their parent company, preferably in another town or city. So in 1901, we find Edwin as a journeyman working in refrigeration in the Liverpool area and boarding in Bootle with the Tarn family, who had been near neighbours in Jarrow and who had moved to Bootle, like him, for work. Many of the journeymen apprentices in the Northeast signed up to the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, which gave them a little extra money and other job possibilities. In 1914, on the outbreak of World War I, all RNVR men were immediately called up. At that point, Edwin disappears into the chaos of naval recruitment and surfaces on the Empress of Russia, a large converted passenger liner capable of 22 knots and equipped with four 4.7-inch guns in the rank of engineering sub-lieutenant. In 1915, the Empress of Russia was blockading the southern entrance to the Red Sea and ferrying troops in and out of Yemen. On June the 13th, 1915, the ship was involved in the shelling of the port of Hodeida in modern-day Yemen and suffered damage. Edwin Gidney was severely wounded and he died 2 days later, on June the 15th, of syncope, extreme pain. He was buried at sea with full naval honours. His only commemoration is on the Portsmouth Naval Memorial. In 1919, there was a probate of all the people who had lost their life in the First World War. Edwin's probate was an estate of £115, 7 shillings and 3 pence. Don't laugh. That's worth over £7,750 today. He left his money to Mary Tarn, the family with whom he had previously boarded in Bootle, and the mother of the two sisters, Ada and Nora Tarn, of whom he had become very fond. Thank you for listening.
Oh, thanks, Bill. The events of the Gidney brothers highlight the impact of the war at sea and shows how different lives can be defined. And now to a different story from World War One. Sue is going to discuss her recent discovery about her army ancestors with Ken.
What started your interest in family history, Sue?
When my dad passed away, I found some certificates in his paperwork, which gave me lots of clues and a really good starting point to get started.
What did you hope to achieve?
I hoped there were a few skeletons in the cupboard, good and bad, but I hoped for a few surprises too.
Did you find any? How things panned out?
For a long time, the fun was in learning how to use the family history websites and navigating through all the options to find the information to verify the family members. Being nosy and inquisitive certainly helps. Gaining experience gave me confidence to think a little bit outside of the box.
What does that mean exactly?
Last year, I hit a bit of a brick wall and didn't quite know where to look next for information on my maternal grandmother. By looking on the 1911 census, I noticed that she had several older brothers who would have been of age during World War One. This eventually led to the discovery of 3 of my great uncles who died in the war, World War One. 2 in France and 1 in Gallipoli. They were traced through World War One records. By using the National Archives, I was also able to find some of their regimental diary extracts, which gave an insight into the daily life in the trenches. I was lucky enough to be able to visit the 2 graves in France last year, having traced their graves through the Commonwealth War Graves site. I also found the uncle who died in Gallipoli, and he has his name on the Helles Memorial in Turkey. As my mother, who was born in 1929, never mentioned her 3 uncles lost in the war, finding this information was a surprise to me and my family.
Well, it's often the case with family history research. It's always recommended to ask living relatives their stories. But often topics were kept under wraps and not discussed. Our final chapter in this podcast is from Margaret, talking about boarders, chairs and Sundown Empire theatre performers. Our other Sue has joined her for a chat.
Hi, I'm Margaret and enjoy coming to Family History Group with other members of Wessington and Washington U3A. My mother's diaries have been the main source of research, having been packed away following her death in 1986. I'll be talking about Sunderland, canny old Sunderland, a period of time, 1933 to 1950. Tough time for the working class, who laughed, cried, showed grit and determination and survived. Everyday people, you cannot whack them.
So what's the story, Jack and Ori?
Well, once upon a time, around 1933, Maggie, 28-year-old widow with a 10-year-old son, Tommy, needed to find work urgently. But what and where? She was living in Garden Place, close by Empire Theatre in Sunderland. Perhaps that might offer an opportunity.
What might she do at the theatre?
Well, her only experience, apart from being from a family of 11, was being a domestic servant in a guest house in Whitley Bay in 1921.
She applied to be a charwoman. She'd always been a grafter, helping neighbours and siblings with decorating as they set up home. Money was tight. She was a widow. In 1934, she met Frank.
Well, tell us about Frank.
Well, he was a labourer at ECT, the East Coast Timber Company, and he supported Sunderland FC. He smoked tabs. He liked to bet. So what was he doing at the Empire Theatre? Work at the docks was intermittent, insecure. So he picked up extra cash, working, shifting scenery as a stagehand. 1935, they married in St Patrick's Church, Sunderland, and the three of them moved to 41 Weymouth Drive, to a three-bedroom house with a garden, a separate bathroom and toilet, maybe room for an expanding family, or an opportunity to create her own small business.
To do what?
Well, her mother and grandmother had both taken in Irish labourers as lodgers who came to work in the pits and on the docks from the 1850s, even to the extent of farming out their eldest child to relations in order to earn some extra cash, or maybe offer bed and breakfast for visitors to Sunderland, to Seaburn and to Roker. Tommy left school in 1937, went to work with Frank at ECT. 1938, he died in an accident at work, aged 15. Her pride and her joy.
That must have been tough. How did she cope?
Well, she threw herself into work, joined the union later that year, was promoted to theatre housekeeper, overseeing her women who turned their hands to painting, whitewashing dressing rooms, as well as the usual char duties. There were opportunities here for running a weekly sweep, shared Liverpool's pools and club cards. When money is tight, maybe Lady Luck will call.
Meanwhile, how's the B&B doing?
Well, she started to advertise, but it was friends of the family that were the first paying guests. The Johnstons from Glasgow were friends of Sister Kate, and Harry met Sally from Burnley, and they stayed regularly over the years. A new group of clients established contact over the next few years. Charlie King was a commercial traveller who stayed frequently, and a named room, Charlie's room, and on one occasion he paid his dues with four rather ornate chairs. And there was Mr. Reed, who was an administrator for Moss Empires, the national chain of theatres, was a regular business visitor.
Presumably work at the theatre continued.
Maggie, throughout 1938, was working nightly in the pay box for the Gods or gallery, the cheapest tickets at a tanner, but a long way up those stairs. September, Germany mobilised and attacked Poland.
Did that affect attendance at the theatre?
No change. It remained open, offering shows like The Desert Song, Joe Loss and his band, stars like Vera Lynn, alongside the circus and the panto, perhaps to keep people's spirits up.
What about Frank's contribution to the war?
Firewatch training for Frank at Willington, followed by nightly firewatch at the docks. He passed his first aid test. He became a registered docker, with plenty of work available in Tyne Dock, Newcastle and Jarrah. But more pain in 1942 as Maggie miscarried twins. Bombings were intense through 1943, but the shows and stars kept coming. Rose Marie, Doyley Carr, Tessie O'Shea, Sandy Powell and Wee Georgie Wood, famous names from Variety. Jimmy James and Harry Secombe stayed in September 1943 for a week. They became firm favourites. The war was grim.
Is there any good news?
Well, I was born in 1944, a bouncing baby girl who has been bouncing ever since. The Dock Labour Board under Aaron Bevan in 1947 registered dockers minimum security whether they worked or not, a step towards a brighter future alongside the welfare state and the NHS. Stars of the stage continued to stay. Billy Cotton and his band, Wakey Wakey, appeared in 1948, but there was only one room available, so Alan Breeze, the singer, stayed for a week. I have a clear memory of photos being taken in the back garden. Another boy, Alan, was born, a brother, but only survived 4 months. So was it the loss of the latest child the reason for moving to Wolston Crescent in Fulwell in 1949? Or looking ahead, was it the prospect of good schools? Variety was still going strong with Max Bygraves and Harry Secombe sharing top billing in June 1950. Secombe stayed at the new address. A local couple from Newcastle, Mrs. Kay and Mr. Potts, were already booked. So I was told my bedroom was needed. Oh, no, not a makeshift bed, was made up over the bath. A piece of hardboard with a mattress of foam. Not sure I have a memory of how I slept, but I can claim that Harry Secombe slept in my bed. To be continued.
Oh, thanks, Margaret, for the fascinating insight into the world of boarders and how the theatre was an important part of everyday life for all and launched many future TV stars. That's all from us for now. You have been listening to Wessington and Washington U3A Family History Group. We hope you enjoyed hearing about our family history stories and encounters of the past. In our next episode, we will be discussing Irish connections with a twist, the impact of criminal transportation, Italian ice cream entrepreneurs in Sunderland, and some DNA surprises. But until then, goodbye from us all, and thank you for listening.